Okay, this is your organizer. Pancha kalpa trubhya shakya sindhu bhyeva cha patitanam bhavanevyo vaishnavevyo namo namaha. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So this Sunday morning after the Gita Nagari Rath Yatra, we're all wiped out. We are continuing with Bhagavatam 11.3, Sri Antariksha is discussing, answering this question about Maya by Maharaj Nimi. And just to review briefly, his response goes from text 3 to 16. Two verses, 3 and 4, describe creation and its reasons. Then the next three verses, 5 through 7, talk about the living entity going through the things in this world. And text 7, which is where we finished with it last time, was text 7, kind of sums up and brings us to the next area, annihilation. And it says that in the material world, the living entity is getting bahu abhadra, lots of inauspiciousness, a great deal of much inauspiciousness of the living entity because he's being carried by his karma. He's basically suffering from the moment of creation, as the translation says, until the time of cosmic annihilation, helplessly, from Sarga to Pralaya. And that's the cue to switch to Pralaya. And he now enters into the bulk of his discussion. From 8 on through 7, through 15, 7 verses is basically destruction. That's his focus. The work of Kala, Kala time is emphasized here, destruction. Bhutva, bhutva, praliyate, again and again they come into being, again and again they're destroyed. Bhagavad Gita says, so that's what happened. So now in text 8, we enter into this discussion of destruction, which gets quite specific, actually. With all the others were very overview. This from a distance, this is destruction. So here it starts. When the annihilation of the material elements is imminent, that is, becomes time for it, the manifest cosmos, vyaktam, which consists of drovya and guna, gross objects and modes of nature, vanishes into avyakta, from manifest and then becomes non-manifest. Who does this? It says here, kala, time, it says in the translation, the supreme personality of Godhead in his form of eternal time. We discussed last time from Kapila Dev's description that the Lord is internally situated as the super soul and externally manifest as time. So he withdraws it in this way. So that It says here, listless. Here is a reference to the third canto of Bhagavatam, Kapila Dev's description that how the creation takes place. We discussed this last time. There's a pradana, and the Lord's potent glance through the form of kala, time, and then material actions take place. And that glance has both this kind of energy, this time energy, which makes matter change, and the living entities who enter into material nature. Here they're called in the purport technical arrangements. These things, of course, they don't happen in the spiritual world. But here, the spiritual world is Vishuddha Sattva. There's simply Sattva. In the material world, the three modes are there because passion, there's creation. Sattva, there's maintenance. And tamagun, there's destruction. But in the spiritual world, there's no creation and no destruction, but things are endlessly existing. So therefore, pure sattva. Sattva without being bracketed by anything else. And that's why when Vishnu, the Lord of Vaikuntha, takes charge of a mode in the material world, it's the mode of goodness. That's the one that's proper to him. And then, of course, Brahma and Shiva take care of passion and ignorance, respectively. So now let's go on. Text 9. Now we get a very specific description, cinematic. As cosmic annihilation approaches, a terrible drought takes place on Earth for 100 years. There's no water. For 100 years, the heat of the sun gradually increases. There's global warming for you, huh? And its blazing heat begins to torment the three worlds. So there's drought and something that maybe it's a supernova, you know. This is predicted by scientists. The sun, when it comes near its death, becomes a supernova and expands. So that's the destruction takes place. So that's the first element here. Is there's from the sun above there's drought. First there's drought, and then no water. Makes it hard to live without water. And then from the bottom, the next text, 10, beginning from Patala Loka, the lowest of the subterranean planets, a fire grows, emanating from the mouth of Lord Shankarshana Mukha. He breathes fire, and Urdhvashika, the flame, the flags, the fire, go up and grow in all directions, driven by great winds, and scorches everything. So that's the next thing. Other places in the Bhagavatam it says that this Shankarshana with the tongues of flame is, of course, Ananta Shesha, who's doing this. And he's described elsewhere by Prabhupada in the Bhagavatam as being angry. The Bhagavatam describes him as angry. I think this is in the fifth canto. And why is he angry? Because of all the conditions. So the time of destruction has come, and all these conditioned souls had all this time to make spiritual advancement, and they didn't take advantage of that. So he's angry at them. and so then the fire comes up, driven by great winds. Just like we see in California all the time, this rehearsal for this destruction of great fires and terrible winds which fan the flames of these fires. Then, if the fire isn't bad enough, text 12, the hordes of clouds called Samvartaka pour torrents of rain for 100 years. So maybe when there's a lot of fire and heat, you're praying for rain. Well, you get it in the terrible condition here. Hundreds of years of torrents of rain flooding down in raindrops as long as the trunk of an elephant. Big raindrops. That rainfall, the deadly rainfall, submerges the entire universe in water. Of course, it says there's this ocean at the bottom, this Garba Ocean, so the ocean comes up. And so there's this devastation. After the devastation by fire, there's the devastation by water. So that happens. There's no purport to these verses. They're sort of self-explanatory. And now it gets a little... After the fire and the water, and with the help of wind, of course, is there, has caused devastation. And then we get to text 12. Vairajam, Utsuja Vairaja, Virajam, excuse me, Tata, then Virajam, which is the universe, Utsuja, giving up as his body, Vairaja Purusha, the personality of the universal form, Hiranya Garba Brahma. So then Vairaja Brahma, here it says the soul of the universal form, gives up his universal body, O King, and enters into the subtle unmanifest nature like a fire that is run out of fuel. It goes out. So Brahma leaves his body. You notice that Brahma is described here, the soul of the universal form. So the soul of the universe is Brahma. And Garbhodakshayi Vishnu, or at least is the super soul of the universe. And because Brahma has the conception that the universe is his body, and the living entities in it are all parts of his body. Just like my body also consists of other living entities. The cells in my body, if you take out a piece of skin, it'll stay alive outside of my body if put in a nutrient solution and so on. So the cells in my body seem to be also individual living entities. But those, they are part of my whole body, and I'm the sort of, if I'm a living entity too, I'm the presiding one over all these cells. Somehow these cells go into a organic unity. So this is the universe is called the cosmic organism. That is to say, it's a living being, according to the Bhagavatam. This raises the really fascinating prospect of cosmology as a kind of biology, biocosmology or cosmobiology. Now, to say that something is an organism, like if my body is an organism, each of my cells, let's start with a cell, it's an organism. To be an organism, a living body, that means the whole cell has to be at least or even more unified than any of its parts. Its parts are also unified. Its nucleus and its, what is it called? all those different, so I forgot. But they're unified too. And but it's or it itself is organized with enough feedback and interaction that it's and communication system, so that when one part is affected, the whole body, the whole thing responds. So simply, my body itself is at least as unified, if not more unified, than any of the cells or systems that make it up. This is what we mean by organic universe, unity. So it seems from this that the universe itself is a living organism. That has lots of implications for cosmology. And so it has a soul. And that soul is Brahma. He's called here the Vairaja Purusha, the soul of the personality of the universal form, Hiranyagarbha Brahma. And so he leaves. It says here he gives up the Virajam, the universe. He gives it up. And avyaktam vishite, he enters the unmanifest material nature, which we've already seen is and which is shukshma, subtle, the subtle unmanifest material nature. He gives it up. So we're describing the death of Brahma here. And so there's a kind of fever, and there's a kind of excess water, like leaving his body. Now, I want to just point out to you that this word Vairaja has many various uses. Remember, and you see in the word for word, the personality of the universal form, but then the word Hiranyagarbha Brahma is used. And in the Bhagavatam, that has quite, there's a variety of uses, because here we see this Vairaja Purusha, the personality of the universal form, denotes Brahma. But in other places in the Bhagavatam, in the second canto, for example, the same word Vairaja Purusha denotes the personality of Godhead, as in the universal form of, just as the universal form of the Lord. Well, it is the Lord's universal form, but here it denotes the Lord in that way. In the fifth canto, the sun god is known as Vairaja. The sun god is also known as Vairaja, the total material body for all living entities. I'm reading from 5:20:44. Because he entered this dull egg of the universe at the time of creation, he is also called Martanda. He is also known as Hiranyagarbha. This is the sun god we're talking about, because he received his material body from Hiranyagarbha, Lord Brahma. So the sun god's called Hiranyagarbha. Lord Brahma's called Hiranyagarbha. And the sun god's also called Vairaja. And Prabhupada says in a purport, 5:20:44, whether Brahma is the supreme personality of Godhead, sometimes he is, or an ordinary living being, he is known as Vairaja Brahma and Hiranyagarbha Brahma. Therefore, the sun god is also accepted as Vairaja Brahma. There's a connection between Brahma and the sun god. And Prabhupada quotes Vishwanath Chakravarti saying that the actual life and soul of all living entities within this universe is the sun. So there's this relationship that between Brahma and Surya and Super Soul, which I don't know that much more about. Yeah, Hiranyagarbha also denotes the Super Soul. Agarbhodakshayi Vishnu, many places also. And Virat worship, those yogis who concentrate on the universal form of the Lord, is called Hiranyagarbha worship. And Prabhupada says in the second canto, the Lord as Garbhodakshayi Vishnu or Hiranyagarbha Supersoul enters into each and every universe and causes it to be animated and so on. So he's also called Hiranyagarbha in many places. There's the gross Virat form. It's a gross manifestation. Then the Hiranyagarbha is the subtle manifestation at the super soul. Prabhupada also says, persons who are worshippers of Hiranyagarbha, the plenary expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Garbhodakshayi Vishnu. So here he calls him an expansion of Garbhodakshayi Vishnu, other places Garbhodakshayi Vishnu. But anyway, persons who are worshippers of Hiranyagarbha, super soul, do not directly approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead in Vaikuntha. They remain within the universe on Satyaloka or other higher planets until the end of the life of Brahma. Then with Brahma, they are elevated to the spiritual kingdom. So that's where they go. And then, of course, we see Brahma is also called Hiranyagarbha in many places. When Hiranyakashipu is praying to Brahma, he addresses him as Hiranyagarbha. Anyway, so there's a kind of complicated stuff going on with here. It said, oh, by the way, in the Brahma Samhita, just to clarify things further, in text 22 in the purport, it says, the four-faced Brahma, the image of self-enjoyment, derives his origin from the prototype Brahma, or Hiranyagarbha, the mundane seminal principle, who regards the aggregate of all mundane entities as his own proper body. And that's also in the purport of today's verse. According to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the word Vairaja in this universe indicates the totality of individual conditioned souls who originally take birth from Brahma and are amalgamated back into him at the time of annihilation. So that's this word of Vairaja. And it says he in the Brahma Samhita, he has this, he regards the aggregate, the whole collective total of all mundane entities as his own body. And so this way we understand that technically speaking, Brahma is the soul of the universe, Garbhodakshayi Vishnu is the super soul of the universe, or maybe an expansion of Garbhodakshayi Vishnu is the super soul of the universe. Here in the purport, it's mentioned several times, this Prabhupada, he says that the the universal form is something like imagination. It's imagination. My understanding of imagination is that you imagine it to be the ultimate form of the Lord, but it doesn't mean it's fictitious or merely a metaphor. This is actually a universal biology. And in fact, Kapila Dev in the third canto, 29th or 26th chapter, which we've been looking at, he goes on to describe the formation of the universe as a kind of embryology, which is there's an egg and there's various orifices made and the various sense organs appear and so on. When the deva, who's in charge of that sense organs, enters into this cosmic egg. Also in this purport, there's some discussion about evidence that Lord Brahman's goes back to Godhead at the time of annihilation. This is supported by Sridhar Maharaj. At the time of final annihilation, all self-realized souls enter with Brahma into the supreme abode. And we've seen Prabhupada quotes that at least those who are on Satya Loga and the other higher planets go with him. In fact, in the second canto, there's quite an elaborate description of those transcendentalists who don't make it all the way, go to Marhaloka, Tapaloka, Janaloka, and of course eventually Satyaloka. But those who are on Marhaloka, for example, when the fire comes up from the bottom, we discussed this fire, when the fire finally reaches them, a vimana, a spaceship, comes, and they get on board, and then it carries them, it picks everybody up and takes them up to Satyaloka. There was a movie when I was a kid about, it was called When Worlds Collide, I think the world was going to be destroyed, and everybody gets on a spaceship and goes off. Well, this is the original story of being rescued from devastation by a spaceship. So they're carried up by Vimana to Satyaloka, and then when Satyaloka goes, so... because what there's a discussion whether he when he says he goes into the avyakta, that it sounds like he doesn't achieve liberation. And it's interesting that some do attain the planet of Brahma who are not devotees, but they perform ashramedha yajnas and other sacrifices, and they get there. And in certain cases, Brahma himself may not be a devotee. So the avyakta, if he's not a devotee, then it indicates that he enters into some kind of an unmanifest state, material nature, and then the other unmanifest is the spiritual sky. And then he quotes in the purport Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur that there's three categories of Brahmas: those who are Karmis, and those who are Gyanis, and those who are Bhaktas. And so the one who's a Karmi has to come back to the material world. That a Karmi mean a performer of big sacrifices, not somebody in a New York City street corner. We call karmis, but actually a karmi is a very, very pious person. Those that are typically called karmis in ISKCON are vikarmis. So a great karmi, he comes back, he's a jnani, he becomes liberated into entering the spiritual sky. And the devotee Brahma will be liberated. But it's mentioned here again also that there's a Brahma who is a devotee but still has this case of Veda Drishya, a tendency to see himself somewhat as separate from the Lord. And so he would attain Mahavishnu's abode at the time of annihilation, but still comes back down again and takes again the post of Brahma. So that's even another state. So all this has been analyzed to where to the the status of Brahma, and he enters into this. And now, so then Brahma has gone out of the universal body, right? Then the body basically decays. And now it's described, deprived of its quality of aroma by the wind, the element of earth is transformed into water. Now this is explained in the purport to the last verse in this section. What is that, verse 17 or 16? Yes, verse number 16. Yeah, that's the last verse. There's a long description that this the gunavishesham, the distinguishing quality of earth is gandha, the quality of aroma, not any particular smell, but somehow simply smell as such or in itself. That's removed by it says wind. And so earth becomes water. Now it's the same thing as water. Once that gunavishesha is eliminated, earth is indistinguishable from water. So the earth is transformed into water. And the same wind, it says here, the same wind then takes rasa out of water, and therefore that water becomes the same as fire or radiance. So now you're just reversing the order of creation. Now let's go on. Same way, then fire, which has this quality of rupa, of form and color and so on. This time it's not wind, but tamasa, it's darkness. Darkness dissolves fire and renders it back into vayu, into air. And then the influence of akasha, of space, then sucks the sparsha out of air, and then there's just space, right? Empty, so-called empty space, mere space, and then its own guna vishesha, its distinguishing quality, is snatched away by Kala Atmana, the Lord in the form of time. And then space is then back into whence it came, which is, as you remember, false ego in ignorance. So it's just reversed. And then it goes on to discover, so that's what's come back in from false ego and ignorance. The Mahabhutas and the Tan Mantras, they're called the gross elements and the subtle sense objects. Then, when you go to false ego in the mode of passion, what's come out of that is the 10 senses and buddhi, intelligence. So those things go back into false ego in the mode of passion, and the manas, mind, and also the devas, who are also produced out of false ego in goodness, they go back and emerge into false ego in the mode of goodness. But Brahma has gone, so now the body he leaves behind sort of wraps up, dissolves, and then you have the total ahankara. It goes back into the Mahatattva. And that's the dissolution of the universal body. And then, I have now described Maya, the illusory energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This illusory potency consisting of the three modes of material nature, see, it's described in terms of these three modes, is empowered by the Lord for creation, maintenance, annihilation of the material universe. Now what more do you wish to hear? And then the purport, we've really covered this purport, because he simply and if you haven't read this, you should read it. It explains all these things again. I want to take my last 2 minutes for talking, just to remind you of something. Now here, this is a kind of physics, and it describes, you know, the creation and dissolution of the universe. Now, obviously, it's not like today's physics, right? Not at all. And today's physics, we think, is true because, well, ultimately, it works. We can do things with it. We can, well, of course, we can make atomic bombs and so many other things, and we see it works. And therefore, we believe it's true. But here, is this just a fantasy? Well, it also works. And the people who knew how to apply it could do things that today we can't do. Because you'll see in many places in the Bhagavatam, when a yogi wants to leave his body voluntarily, he does this same thing. Not with the universal body, but with his own body. He winds up the creation. There's description after description using this physics, not knowing how to search out the various areas with intelligence. He does this. So there's the earliest description in the Bhagavatam is how Dhritarashtra left his body under the instructions of Vidura. And he did it. And in many, many other cases, I could make a list, this is described in the Bhagavatam. And so these were people who did things, used this physics and did things with that physics that today we think of them as imagination because nobody can do it. I mean, there are those mysterious deaths by spontaneous combustion, which nobody can explain, which may have been some inadvertent way of doing this, but people did it by in any way on their own, by their knowledge, and they distinctly took every element of their body and did the same thing, and then the body burned up as by universal fire coming up. And they left. Where did they leave? The Brahmarundra, you know, right from the right. So this individual body. Also, we see, by the way, when yogis like Dhruva could somehow or other identify their individual body with the universal body, they could also control these. When he stopped breathing, the demigods were suffocating. The wind, the universal air had stopped, and so on. So that's another where people using this model, using this physics, they could do things. So if you wanted to, you could do it too. We want to do other things with our time, but anyway, that's the way it goes. Okay. So now we finish this section, and so now Nimi, having heard this really horrific description of Maya and what it means, will ask his next question. Mainly, how do we get out? Even if we're stupid, how could even a foolish person get out of this Maya? So we'll take that up next time. So now I will switch to Q&A mode, and then we can see if there are any discussion or questions. So the Q&A mode is on. You have control over your mute and unmute button. So if you want to say something, then you can unmute yourself, and we'll still have silence from the other muted participants. Okay? Anything? Send my blessings, Radha Bhushana.
Gurudev, I well, one question for clarification. As a reply to King Nimi's question about the illusory energy, Sri Antariksha starts speaking about the entanglement of conditioned soul in this world, the desire for sense gratification, and then he starts suddenly describing annihilation of the universe. I just wonder why he puts the emphasis on the destruction as a response to King Nimi's inquiry.
Yeah, why he puts emphasis on destruction? Well, partly we at least know why this is quoted, because we remember that the 11th canto begins with considerations of annihilation and about fear. Remember that the original question asked by Maharaj Nimi about the Anyantikam Shema is how one can become free from fear. Material existence is innately fearful, and that was his question. And so I think in that spirit he emphasizes this fearful nature of material existence, and that the desire for being a separate enjoyer puts you into this condition. Bhutva praliyate. Prabhupada was talking, quoting this verse on a morning walk in Mayapur. He says, "That very nice? Is that very nice? Again and again created, again and again destroyed. Is that nice?" So in the Bhagavad Gita, where in the 13th chapter, Krishna says, talks about one of the items of knowledge is knowledge of the evils of birth, death, old age, and disease. When Prabhupada comments on that, he says that one should be very pessimistic about this material world. And he gives a little start of the suffering, a suffering of a soul in the womb from the Bhagavatam, and then mentions other suffering. He says these things should be discussed. He said, because if one is not aware of these evils of birth, death, old age, and disease, there is no impetus for spiritual realization. Part of the Maya, the deluding potency, is you think this is a nice place. You think you're having a good time. You think everything is wonderful. That's deluding potency, and a great deal of effort is spent on the maintenance of illusions, and you may notice that sometimes when you see materialistic people in the depths of their enjoyment, how their celebrations have this kind of driven, strained quality about them. Mm-hmm. Like they're sort of proving something, that we're having a great time and don't tell me otherwise. So I was giving a class in the temple in New York City, the one in Brooklyn. And I was reading that purport, and there was a lady, a devotee, who really objected to this idea that these things should be discussed. She thought it made us, you know, life-denying and sour and negative, and we would turn people off and so on like that. Yeah. And I take her point, you know, but you shouldn't maintain illusions.
Yeah.
You can't maybe walk up to people on the streets and say, you know, everything is horrible. I mean, I had this experience when I was just coming to the temple as a kind of a guest and thinking about Krishna consciousness as something I could do. And I stepped out of the doorway of the temple was at that time it was near South Street, and I could look out and I could see this sunset, and there's a lady from the temple next to me, and I said, "Oh, what a beautiful sunset." She said, "It is not beautiful. It is horrible." She said, "And if you think it's beautiful, you'll just have to take birth again and again to enjoy it." That was a little off-putting, you know. I could understand why she was saying, but still, it was a beautiful sunset, you know. Come on, you know. And so there's tactful ways to deal with the situation, like saying, "Yes, it is beautiful, but consider how much more beautiful is that from which it came." Or, "Yes, the sunset is described in the Bhagavatam as the clothes, the dress of the Lord," you know, or something like that. You know, there's a way to do it. But at the same time, one shouldn't maintain illusions about this material world. It's therefore our instruction, and so that's why I believe Maharaj, Sri Antariksha, answers his question in this way. It has to do with his very first question about freedom from fear, and so he describes what a fearful condition the material world is for those who want to stay here. And of course, that's quoted also, as being quoted by Narada Muni to Vasudev, who's also in they're all in a fearful state because the Yadu dynasty has been cursed to be annihilated, and Krishna is going to disappear soon. So it's all the whole thing is very filled with apprehension of future calamities. Mm-hmm. So we should that's my take on why this emphasis is here on Maya. And on the form of time, the Kala Shakti. Okay?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Anyone else? Don't be afraid. Okay. Then Shraddha here suggests, since we have a little bit of time, anybody wants to say hello or just chat or something for our time, you can do that now. And let me look at my schedule.
Gurudev?
Yeah.
I did have what I think will be a short question.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, it should be, because it's not about practice. It's purely theoretical, so I don't know if it'll require added clarification or not. But I was trying to understand how it is that Earth can transform into, I guess it's water and things like that, and how the elements can transform into each other when they lose their distinguishing guna.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think it has to do with the fact that Prakriti is kind of like pure potentiality, and in that sense, Prakriti can almost take any conceivable form in the material world just according to, I don't know, how it's configured or something like that?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Maybe so. You know, I really don't know how this physics works. And I'm not even sure that the earth, water, fire, and air, ether that we actually perceive are the elements themselves. You know, already when we see them, they're kind of aggregates of, they're not unmixed, and they're aggregates of various qualia, objects of sense perception. And so these may refer to a kind of, what should we say, elemental earth, elemental fire, elemental water, and so on, which is not exactly the same thing as the earth, air, fire, water, and so on that we recognize. So I think there's some research. I know Rasaraj has a whole kind of investigation into this kind of prospect that these are not really that it's much more sophisticated than, you know, the earth, water, fire, and air, and so forth of medieval philosophy and so on. Bhakti Siddhanta calls them solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and space. Which immediately gives them a different kind of a connotation too. So I really don't know that our understanding may right now be a little simplistic of these things. But I can't say anything more about that. I don't know.
Okay.
How to refrain from speculating.
Okay, thank you.
Hold myself back.
maybe when the tape recorder is off, I'll ask you again.
Okay.
Thanks, Guru.
No, I really don't know that much about this part of it. This kind of physics that is there.
Are you under the impression from your work with this planetarium project that there has been kind of more work done on this stuff by previous commentators and philosophers, just like in the medieval time? Like, you know,
I really haven't looked into this. It's just more or less my suspicion that it's a lot more sophisticated than we think. As you know, that in the various schools of thought, like say the varieties of Sankhya and so on, which deal with these things, there's records of their, you know, we have some of their writings, but they're not written for outsiders to understand.
Yeah.
You know, you're supposed to be in a community of investigators who talk among themselves and we may be in a position of somebody like today who doesn't know anything about modern physics and gets pages of quantum mechanical formulas and is trying to figure out what it means. You know, what are you going to do? I think these things can be rediscovered, but it's going to take a little while. And not just by mental speculation, I mean really by some kind of a guidance from the super soul. To grasp these kind of things. Next week we have a conference call, class scheduled on the 10th. August 3rd, right? Yeah, look at my. I'll also be in Gitanagari on August 3rd, and I have to just want to tell you I'll be talking from there. Of course, Gitanagari, you can't get a hold of a decent phone line. At least I can't use my cell phone unless I drive out to 20 miles away to get connection. But I'll still try to give class from Gitanagari somehow or other. But it may be a little bit complicated. But we'll keep it on the schedule. So that's why I'll say goodbye for now and talk to you all on August 3rd. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Aki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Aki Jai.